And that concludes my opening comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Questions from the board? I saw Mr. Sanford's hand first. Go ahead, Mr. Sanford.
Do you have a see any difference in the language not inconsistent with versus is consistent with?
I do. That actually, if you go to page, two eighty-nine of the board packet, I did address that that issue in comment number 24. There were a couple of comments that we received during the comment period about the, you know, the nature of the construction of that language, the double negative. And what I see there is a difference in the, I would look at it as a difference in the nature of the evidence that would be required to make a positive finding with regard to the standard. It would not be a situation where we would require a prescribed list of submissions to address the standard. But the standard is there, and we would have the ability to consider it and to make it part of the proceeding if it was relevant and appropriate. So I look at it as a situation where it would allow us to make a positive finding if there was no evidence to the contrary, essentially. Which is a bit different than having a prescribed list of detailed standards that submissions must be made around.
So it kind of has to do with the burden of persuasion, or
it does. And I see this also as a situation where I think potentially it would not necessarily add to the regulatory burden of applicants. But again, it keeps the door open and would allow consideration of the environmental justice concept if it was demonstrated that it was relevant and appropriate to a particular proposal.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Pelletier.
Thanks, Chair. And thank you, Paula. You know, there's a long history to the evolution, a lot of these standards and the statutes, and I'm just trying to get my own head up to speed to things that I think the board has been probably dealing with more recently. And so I don't want to rehash a lot of stuff that's already been debated. And when it goes to the waste generated within the state, as the statutes reads in the definition, we're essentially still bringing in waste from out of state that's classified as waste generated within the state, correct?
There is out of state waste coming into Maine. Who can handle that and the ways in which it's being handled? That gets into the complexities of this issue.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, one of the major issues with regard to that is that by law, the state-owned landfill cannot accept waste from out of state. One of the driving forces behind this discussion is the fact that the law provides that residues from waste processing facilities become in-state waste by virtue of the fact that they were processed within the state of Maine. So that processing residue, you know, from one of the processors in particular, going to the state-owned landfill, is one of the central issues with regard to this whole matter before you.
I understand, and that part I've got, and I assume it's because these wastes are all burned together. That segregating all that stuff or separating it into different just it becomes a an impossible task. And so.
Well, I think there are some distinctions between both incinerators and processing facilities are referenced in the statute. And in the case of incinerators, I think it's a practical matter where it's you know, it would be impossible to segregate ash from an incinerator to determine, you know, which ash came from out-of-state waste and which did not. And I think that that was one of the original conversations that drove the enactment of that law in the first place, that practical matter for incinerators. Some of them do accept out-of-state waste on a seasonal basis, for instance, in order to maintain their boiler operation. If the waste is, in-state waste is down, they'll take out-of-state waste. None of them take a lot of it, but they do take it from time to time. And so they are in a situation where they can view their ash as in-state waste because the incineration occurred in Maine, even if some of that came from out of state. It's a little bit different with a processor. The operations are different. So what we've been talking about in that regard is primarily the processing of construction demolition debris. It results in a large volume of residue. The largest percentage of the material that's actually coming into the facility leaves the facility as residue. And that is used to some extent as alternative daily cover in landfills. But primarily, those construction demo processing facilities are producing residues for use as alternative daily cover.
Again, I understand that makes sense, is my understanding. And I expect you probably don't have a good handle. We're dealing with the state of Maine in terms of what other New England states are doing and how they regulate solid waste is kind of above and beyond your role here. But is there something that the state of Maine's not doing that it makes it economically feasible for daily truckloads from out-of-state waste to be coming up here on a regular basis?
Well, that's there are a number of factors. You know, that's a complicated question.
And I hate bringing up some of these things that I know have been long debated, but again, I haven't had that opportunity.
No, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's completely relevant, you know, to this conversation. A couple of things about the waste that comes in. I mean, first of all, people, you know, whoever they are, the parties that are looking to dispose of waste are always looking for, you know, the cheapest options, the easiest options, for available options, because in certain parts of the Northeast, availability of options for disposal or processing are pretty limited. One of the issues, and you'll see this in the basis statement because it is addressed there, one of the issues is that Massachusetts, for instance, has put into place a number of bans on the disposal of certain types of waste in landfills in Massachusetts. So one of the bans that they've put on waste has to do with, it's not construction demolition debris across the board, but certain components of construction demolition debris. And they did that to drive recycling rates, basically. They're looking to decrease the amount of waste that's disposed and to drive an increase in recycling. For various reasons, you know, a lot of that out-of-state waste makes it to the processing facilities in Maine. I don't think it's a single factor that causes it to go there, but I think that it's combinations of, you know, cost, logistics, availability of options, And the fact that in Massachusetts, in part because of the bans they've imposed, options for disposal are pretty limited. We've looked at bans on various things in Maine. A number of other states, for instance, have placed bans on the disposal of organics, food waste. And it can be a very effective tool to drive recycling of different types of waste materials. But and we do look at it periodically here. To this point, what we've concluded pretty consistently is that it would be difficult to do that for certain wastes in Maine because we do not have the infrastructure in place, such as Massachusetts. Their recycling infrastructure is much better developed than ours. There are more options. And to put a waste ban on construction demolition debris would mean that, you know, a town in northern Maine with no other option would not be allowed to dispose of it in their landfill. And the same with organics. We've had that conversation recently. It can be effective in driving people to recycle and better manage organics. But before you do that, you need to make sure that your infrastructure is sufficient to support all of the material that would be sent to those facilities.
Thank you very much.
Mr. DeShane.
Yes, thank you. And if I go on too long, give me a shock collar and activate as necessary. Ms. Buck, I just want to establish the timeline a little bit on this. This petition on its face looks like it's an end around what the legislature did, but in reality, the petition was circulated and signatures were gathered long before anything, a bill went to the legislature and long before this came to the department as a petition. So in reality, this is a proposal that's been sitting out there for quite a while and preceded what the legislature did. Am I correct about that?
The petition came in January, and the legislature was discussing this issue in January. It was carried over from the first session. So the conversation about the definition started in 2019, the legislative conversation. No agreement was reached on what the bill would look like. It was carried over, and that discussion was concluded in the second session.
So basically, this petition was drafted and circulated and submitted before the legislature had actually finally acted on its bill. That's right?
Yes, I believe.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? Ms. Lessard.
To sort of cut to the chase here, in terms of the biggest portion of this, which will, if this is adopted, remain unaddressed, is relates to this definition of waste. And am I correct that maybe the AG's office can help with this also, but it's my understanding from reading this information provided by the department that even if we wanted to change the definition of related to waste, we don't have the authority because the legislature has enacted a law that specifically defines that, and our role is rules related and interpretation of law, but not creating new. Is that sort of where we sit with this? Because I've heard that this discussion has gone on for a long time, a lot longer than 2019. You know, for those of us who've been involved with waste in some manner, it feels like it's been forever. But are we really preempted in our authority here to do this? That's what I read in what's provided is that even if we wanted to adopt what was presented, that we don't have the legal authority to do so.
That's correct. Kate can certainly weigh in on that, but that is my understanding of the situation. I mean, rules can certainly elaborate on statutory language, and a lot of our rules do that, as you know. They can clarify points that need to be clarified that are in statute, but the rule cannot be inconsistent or contrary to the statute. Which is the circumstance that we would have here.
And I don't have anything further to add. I think both of you have said that correctly.
So really the ball, so to speak, would be in the court of the legislature to make a change in this if it were to happen. And that's what they just did in 2020 and didn't change it.
Correct. Just to be clear, there was a change in 2020 from what had been the language in the statute. The department had put forward some alternative language for the legislature's consideration. We had some concerns about the existing language, and we had put forward a piece to address that. That was the starting point, the legislature's conversation about this issue. And over the course of the first and second sessions of the 129th, that language evolved to what you see before you today. I think the piece that is most different is that there is an exception in that language it is a single processing facility. The Re-Energy facility has an exception within that statutory language specifically prescribed and carved out in the statutory language. So this, in general, this definition in statute that was passed in 2020 is different than the one that preceded it. But it is not consistent with the requests that have been made by the petitioners.
And in effect, that exemption created for Re-Energy by the legislature deals with more than 90% of the out-of-state waste that we're talking about in this issue. Is that correct?
The numbers for Re-Energy in 2018, Re-Energy took into its facility roughly 214,000 tons of CDD. 9% of that was main waste. The remainder was from Massachusetts and New Hampshire. The 2019 number is 235,000 tons. Again, 9% being main waste and the remainder Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Other questions from board members? Mr. DeShane.
Yes.
Mr. Parker, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I've only been dealing with solid waste for, 35, 40 years, something like that. Since I've been on the board, there have been several attempts to try to control what comes into the state of Maine's owned landfill by not accepting state waste. And it seems so every time somebody does something, there's some little rule that gives an exception basically to the operator of the facility. And I don't think that's right. I'm not in a position where we can vote to change the legislation, but we don't have to adopt it. We can say we don't agree with it and send it back to them for reconsideration. I think this simple petition that's before us is pretty straightforward. And if they want to put out-of-state waste in non-state-owned landfills, then that may be a different issue. But right now, it's just an excuse to take the Massachusetts waste and use it in our landfill and call it daily cover, so they can charge for trucking, they can charge for disposal, they can charge for handling, and the state gets zero out of it. I'm not in favor of what's there right now, because it's just a rehash of the same thing. And it's sort of an affront to the people who put the petition out, because it ignores basically what they're trying to accomplish. I'll be quiet.
Mr. DeShane, you got a question?
Yes, thank you. And again, the Attorney General's office and staff have already made it clear that we can't pass something that is different and inconsistent with the law. I think probably there's no impetus to go there. But what the legislature did something different instead in tackling this exact issue, because most of the out-of-state waste that we're arguing about is coming to one facility and then going to Juniper Ridge. And the question for a decade at least has been, is the Re-Energy facility really a recycling facility, or is it a transfer station? Well, we've been treating it as a recycling facility, but again, only about 10% of what comes out of there goes somewhere besides Juniper Ridge. So substantively, it's been acting as a transfer station. What the legislature did, I believe this last time, was say, look, if the only product you're making is alternative daily cover, we're going to start treating you differently and maybe look at you as a transfer station, but you've got this number of years to improve your process. I would ask Paula about why those years were chosen, because this same percentage has been in existence for at least a decade. There have been promises to improve and they didn't happen. So it appears we're being a little generous. Do you wish to comment on that?
If I could just go back a step for maybe the benefit of some of the others that are not as well versed in this as Mr. DeShane is. But part of the legislation that we've been referring to and a proposal that was put forward by the department was that processing facilities would be required to demonstrate that at least 50% of what they were claiming to have recycled from their facilities would have to be recycling in a setting outside of a landfill, something other than placement of a landfill. So all processing facilities by law are required to recycle to the maximum extent practicable, but in no case less than 50%. And the department requires reporting each year. We review those results to ensure that they've recycled at least 50% of what comes in. What this law would do is to say, okay, if you've recycled 50%, at least 50% of that 50% has to be outside of a landfill setting. So for other facilities, that holds true in this legislation. You know, as I mentioned in one of the documents, there's only one other commercial processing facility in Maine, and it doesn't take nearly the volumes that Re-Energy does. But if there were others, that 50% of 50% would apply to them. The exception is strictly for Re-Energy. The dates that are in there evolved through discussion and extended discussions among Re-Energy, the department, and the legislature. They were tied into Re-Energy's operations and their plans for modifications at the facility that they believe are going to allow them to increase their recycling rates. So these are dates that Re-Energy believed they could meet given the plans that they have in place for their facility.
And just to follow up, in order to accomplish that, they're going to have to change a lot, it would appear to me. For one thing, a lot of what comes in there is not burnable wood, it's mattresses. I'm not sure how they ever get to the figure unless there's some major changes going on there. Is there a process where the department's going to monitor the improvements in this recycling process?
We absolutely will be monitoring what they do. As I mentioned earlier, each year facilities are required to report. We have a detailed reporting format, and we ask them to calculate the recycling rate and to give us detailed information on the origin of all the waste and the ultimate disposition of that waste. So we will be monitoring their progress through that reporting system. Well, as you know, the specifically, it requires for that facility 15% by January 1, 2022, and 20% January 2023. And the final piece in the statutory language was that we included a section that requires the department to evaluate this situation in the context of the next update to the Maine Solid Waste Management Plan and to make recommendations accordingly. So that's how that would play out.
Other questions from Ms. Lessard and then Mr. Pelletier.
So if the board has no authority to deal with the definition of that, does the department have the ability to define alternative daily cover in a way that precludes the use of this material as a methodology? Because if you can't get there one way, you can get there another.
The statutory language is quite clear that it includes daily cover. I'm not certain how you would define daily cover to preclude its use as daily cover. It has a specific meaning. Alternative daily cover, I honestly don't recall if it's defined in chapter 400, but there is discussion about alternative daily cover within the rule, at least. And alternative daily covers are required to be approved for specific landfills. There is detailed language about how they can be used, you know, the depth to which they can be applied and so forth. So there is a body of rule around alternative daily cover that certainly suggests what that use entails.
Mr. Pelletier.
Ms. Clark, I'm assuming, you know, there's good job security here. This is not going to finish up here with this. And I know we've got PFAS issues to be looking at here, that's going to be something that's going to further evolve. And the update you just mentioned is probably going to be dealing with that in terms of monitoring. But I'm wondering, state of Massachusetts, they have certain bans on the level of toxicity of the waste that they accept, and yet that waste is still coming up here. How is that being addressed here? Can we better look at some of these that concern?
Well, the bans, generally speaking, the bans they're not based depending on what the waste is, it may have something to do with toxicity, but the primary driver, as I mentioned before, is that they are looking to ensure that the materials that they're banning from landfills are being, that recycling is being maximized. So the decision was not necessarily that CDD waste is toxic, so we're not going to allow it in Massachusetts. They are trying to cause a situation where those materials are being recycled. Recycling is being maximized rather than disposing of the material in Massachusetts. I mean, toxicity is, you know, is always a factor, but it is the recycling issue that is a principal driver.
Thank you. You all set, Mr. Pelletier?
As much as I can be. Thanks. Yeah.
So I'm gonna jump in here. I've been very patient. Oh, go ahead, Jim.
Well, it just listen to what was just said. It sounds to me like Maine is providing an end run around what Massachusetts is trying to accomplish. And we're just not allowing Massachusetts to reach its goals because we're giving them a free place to get rid of it, basically.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my comments, I guess. I have numerous comments that I will reserve until we get into actual deliberation amongst board members, but I do have a couple of questions from Ms. Clark. And I'll start with the first one. You know, I tend to agree that, you know, Massachusetts apparently took these steps to drive recycling. And you noted that they have, you know, an enhanced infrastructure to allow that to happen. But I guess from my perspective, it's not happening. So my question is, you know, what type of communications or what are the channels of communication between the state of Maine, the department, and the folks in Massachusetts to say, hey, this is causing us issues. You know, ultimately, this material has to go somewhere. It has to be disposed of. And right now, and I don't know what the percentages are, maybe a significant percentage of the demo debris from Massachusetts is being recycled in Massachusetts. I don't know what those numbers are. But what efforts is Maine taking to say, to communicate back, kind of give the feedback back to the state of Massachusetts that your actions are causing us issues? Does that happen?
There certainly have been those conversations. You know, ultimately, I think it comes down to, you know, the state of Massachusetts is not able to tell waste generators that they can't take their waste to the state of Maine. I mean, obviously, that's a market issue, and you know, there are interstate commerce issues that play here as well. In terms of Maine communicating with the other states, you know, interestingly, that does happen on a pretty regular basis. A lot of that communication goes on among the states within the NUMOA organization, the Northeast Waste Management Officials Association. One of the things that is done with some regularity is that we look at the flow of interstate waste. Where it's generated, where it goes, and we do have those discussions. I mean, it has not resulted, nor could it, in Massachusetts saying, okay, you know, there will be no more Massachusetts CDD sent to Maine. But I think that all the states are pretty well aware of how that waste is flowing and, you know, the volumes, who the generators are, and where it's going.
So thank you. And the other question I had is much more specific, and it's off of the out-of-state waste topic for a minute. And I want to talk a little bit more about the environmental justice standard that's been added to the public benefit determination section. And this is kind of, I think, a follow-up to the very first question that Mr. Sanford asked. And that question would be, how does an applicant seeking a public benefit determination demonstrate compliance with that standard? You know, what submissions are going to be required by the department, and how does the department then reach a conclusion that the proposal meets that standard? It's not clear to me how that would work.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we were not looking at it as a situation where we would come forward with a prescribed list of submissions. I think that in general, the concept of environmental justice, you know, obviously is a very big, broad, wide open topic. You know, there are a host of, you know, possible scenarios or specific issues that could be raised under that general umbrella. I guess I would envision it as a situation where an applicant would look at the new definition of environmental justice, would consider what environmental justice means in the context of their proposal, and would put forward, would consider that certainly, and put forward general statements or information with regard to environmental justice. You know, if they don't believe that there is any kind of an issue or a problem with regard to environmental justice, they would put that forward. It could be challenged if opponents to a particular proposal were concerned about some aspect of a proposal in the environmental justice context. The language would allow them to build a case around that and present it that would be considered as part of that public benefit proceeding. The definition that's being put forward means the right to be protected from environmental pollution and to live in and enjoy a clean and healthful environment, regardless of ancestry, class, disability, ethnicity, income, national origin, or religion. It also includes the equal protection and meaningful involvement of all people with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of waste management laws, regulations, and licensing decisions. So I could see this coming up if there were opponents to a proposal and they believe that some aspect, some prong of that definition was in some sense being violated by the proposal that's being put forward. That would initiate a deeper discussion and deeper consideration of the environmental justice piece. If no issues are raised, as I mentioned before, I think a positive finding around that could be made unless evidence to the contrary is put forward.
Mr. Chair, if I can pipe in with a real world example.
Sure. That's okay, what I'm looking for, is something in real world.
Okay. This one has perplexed me for a while. A few decades ago, the Penobscot Nation got some of its land back, finally, after a couple of centuries. And then we put the Juniper Ridge landfill in West Old Town adjacent to Penobscot land. A decade later, the Municipal Review Committee comes back in with a permit looking to put a landfill in Argyle, again, next to Penobscot, adjacent to Penobscot land. If anyone is able to make a positive argument that they are being environmentally, justice being denied them, I would have been the Penobscots in this case, I think. I think this was a real world example of where environmental justice can be demonstrated, or an injustice can be demonstrated by somebody who's opposing a project. So not only could this happen, I think it already has.
And I should be clear, I am not opposed to the concept. My issue is, and again, I'll reserve most of this for when we get into deliberation, because it's not a question, it's an opinion. But my issue is taking a policy or a concept and trying to make it a regulation by simply saying it's now a regulation. And from the standpoint of the regulated community, I understand 60 mil HDPE liners. I understand setbacks from significant natural resources. I understand that. This, to me, just seems to be very difficult. It's very ambiguous, and it's complex, and it's building more ambiguity and complexity into something that's already that way. So I understand that, and I'm not opposed to that. Don't get me wrong. I'm just, I can see this being something that could potentially drag out even more some of these permitting processes because it's not clear. There's not a clear set of standards or submissions that an applicant needs to meet. And that's what I'm struggling with. And we can talk more about that. But that's why I asked the question as to what the department would be looking for and how are they going to make that determination of whether or not a project or an application is in compliance with that standard or not. And, you know, we'll talk more about that when we get to that point. So any other questions from board members?
One other quick one, if I might.
Go ahead, Mr. DeShane.
Yes, thank you. I just want to get my math right. We talk about out-of-state waste filling up Juniper Ridge. At the current fill rates, it looks like maybe 1/4 of what's going to Juniper Ridge is crossing the bridge in Kittery. Is that relatively close to accurate?
It may be. I'm sorry. I don't have the numbers right in front of me.
But no, neither do I.
Easily enough.
Yeah. And I have a recollection that Massachusetts produces maybe 1 million tons of CDD a year, which means that 1/5 of that is coming north to Maine. But I don't remember if that 1 million tons is something I made up or if I actually read it. Do you have any ballpark idea of what Massachusetts actually produces?
I don't, but I can get that number easily enough. I'm sure it is far in excess of the, you know, the amount that's going to re-energy, but I don't know what percentage that represents.
Yeah, I guess my point is, yeah, a lot of it's coming up here, but they're also stuck with a lot more of it, and I don't know how they're dealing with it. So thanks, I appreciate it.
Any other questions for Ms. Clark? Okay, thank you.